CliffCentral.com.
Well, CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning means one thing and one thing only. It means the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. And Nando's, we were talking about their ad just the other day for Piet Rampedi and for all the people all the people who are interested in that story about the kids who were born, the supposed decuplets who were born some time ago. Some very clever advertising from Nando's there. And we're looking forward this morning to unpacking a whole lot of really, really interesting things that are going on in the news, the stories that are occupying our minds politically, socially, and economically. And this morning is no is absolutely not any different to any of the other episodes of this, except that we've got two really amazing guests. One of them a return champion and someone who we are very happy to have back. Canthan Pillay, it's good to see you, Canthan. How are you?
Morning, guys.
Yes, very good.
Fabulous.
I'm very pleased to hear
it. Hello, Canthan.
Don't we have a birthday? We have a birthday coming up soon, don't we, Canthan?
We do have a birthday coming up soon, and it's a big 6-0.
Ooh, big 6-0.
Wow.
Nice. Things to celebrate. Well, I mean, with your... Go on, Pums.
Are you going to have a big, like, lockdown rules breaking party, like a certain MEC?
Well, no, I'm only inviting my immediate family, which means I've got about 600 people.
Don't doubt it for a second. Yeah, that's a big one to celebrate, though. But the silver hair has been there for some time, so you can't even claim that that's novel.
Yeah, I've had the silver hair since my 20s, actually. So it's just kind of increased in volume since then.
Right. Well, we're going to be joined in a moment.
Which is good hair for a 60-year-old.
It's very good hair.
You know, let's not go down that route, Pumi, because if I start saying similar things in your direction, then I'll be accused of rampant sexism and all of that kind of stuff.
Yes. And we will get to our other guest this morning in a moment. He's just busy sorting out his microphone, and we're going to find out what's going on over there with him in a moment. But he's brought to the market a brand new book, which is called A Pretoria Boy. So I have this in common with our guest. I'm also a Pretoria boy, and I suppose you could also say people like Elon Musk are. And what we all have in common is it's very difficult to figure that out, but we all sort of have a bit of a rebellious streak. And this guy has a huge rebellious streak because he started looking for trouble at an early age, and trouble found him. He is Peter Hain. Lord Peter Hain, how are you?
Good, thanks very much. Nice to talk to you again, Jeremy.
Nice to see you too. It's good to have you on the show this morning. We're going to talk a little bit about your book in a moment, but we'll also get to all the stuff that I know that you're more interested in than most people who live in the UK, and that is South Africa and South African politics and the ongoing mess within the ANC. Our elections are supposedly coming up. There are so many things we can get into. But why have you brought out this book? Because I think your story is quite well known to many of us. Is this the earlier years, the stuff that we don't know, Peter?
Well, I've not had a book published in South Africa before about my story. And when Jonathan Ball discussed it with me, they thought they'd be interested in it, which starts off with the exposing the money laundering and the complicity of the international corporations in the Zuma-Gupta looting. Then goes back to the beginning of my childhood and so on. So somebody like you, Gareth, who's delved into my background, perhaps it is familiar, but I think to a lot of people it's completely new, whether it is anti-apartheid activism in London after my family was forced to go into exile in the 1960s, receiving a letter bomb and things like that, of the sort that security forces assassinated anti-apartheid leaders across the world with. I think probably there will be a lot new in it, and certainly people have been very kind in giving a verdict if they've read it.
Oh, absolutely. And I would recommend to anybody, not just people who are interested in you, but also people who are interested in the history of this country. I mean, you go into your involvement in the House of Lords and what you've done to try and expose the laundering, the money laundering, the corruption in the Jacob Zuma administration, which is recent history. You know, the stuff that you've been doing across the seas and across the rest of Africa to make sure that South Africa remains top of mind in the UK. And there are also some lovely pictures in here. I saw a picture of you with Madiba, you with Ahmed Katrada. There's also a lovely picture of you standing in front of your old school in Pretoria.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yes, well, there's all of that. But I suppose the motivation for it was that when I did, at the request of Pravin Gordhan and other senior ANC figures in the run-up to the conference at the end of 2017, when former President Zuma was hoping to continue his dynasty with his favoured candidates and Cyril Ramaphosa was challenging him, they wanted the story that had become well-known inside South Africa after brave investigative journalists had exposed it, of the looting and the corruption under Zuma and the Gupta brothers. They wanted the international dimension to it exposed. And that's where I was able to help, and they asked me to do it. And I described my source or sources as a deep throat who,
right,
inside the Zuma state, who gave me all of the information that I used under parliamentary privilege. But the important point about it was that up until that point, it had been a story confined largely to South Africa,
mm-hmm,
well known inside South Africa.
Right.
But suddenly, it was on the front pages of the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post when I exposed it under parliamentary privilege. So that caused the corporates involved, HSBC Bank, Standard Chartered, Bank of Baroda, the McKinsey's, the KPMG's and the rest of them, who would basically be getting the fat fees and helping with the money laundering and the corruption. Suddenly they felt the heat. And their bosses flew over from New York and so on to meet me in my office in the House of Lords, asked to see me. And I suppose that was that was what that achieved. But suddenly, you know, I found my name up in lights in the South African media. And I think a lot of people, particularly those not necessarily well-read like you, Jeremy, but those perhaps under 60,
yeah,
suddenly thought, what's this British lord? What's he on about?
Right.
And so really the purpose of the book was to say, actually, this British lord was a Pretoria boy, and this is his story. And
it, I think maybe it's right that your name is as well known as it is in South Africa. I certainly hope people will read the book to find out more about your actual story. But the exposure which you gave to this story internationally and in the corporate world is ongoing. I mean, we this chapter is not closed yet, and we are still seeing lots of information coming to the fore. And South Africa kind of owes you a debt of gratitude for that, because this may have remained a small local story, and the Guptas may have been unknown to the rest of the world if it wasn't for some of your efforts there. So I think we owe you a debt of gratitude for that, and I'm pleased to have you on the show this morning. Thank you very much. So we're gonna get straight into it. Pumi, Kanthan, Peter, let's see what we can figure out about where we are at the moment, because there is quite a lot going on. I saw just the other day that Jacob Zuma, who we've just mentioned, is refusing to let the doctors come and examine him. He's too sick, and he says, I'm not going to cooperate. Now, isn't there already a mechanism in South African law by which we don't need you to be present in your own trial? Isn't there a way we can try you in absentia for the things that you are charged with, even if you want to be as uncooperative as possible?
Well, I think that we can take a view that in these COVID times, Gareth, we've got a scenario where we can plonk down a computer in Jacob Zuma's hospital ward,
mm-hmm,
and just ensure that he's part of the trial, whether he wants to be physically present or not.
Yeah, and he doesn't.
Surely there's precedent for it. Now, second point that I want to make in terms of the question of whether or not one can actually force Jacob Zuma to take a medical examination. I think there's a very interesting precedent that came out from a case some years ago that in the Western Cape High Court that was presided over by Judge Siraj Desai,
mm-hmm,
where there was a person who was a suspect in a criminal case that involved shooting. And the way in which he could be identified is if a bullet that was lodged in his leg was actually extricated, and they were able to run ballistic tests on it to show that he was in fact present at the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
And he refused to do so on the grounds that it was going to endanger his health. And in that particular scenario, Judge Desai basically issued an order that the bullet will be removed because there's not going to be a threat to his health, and he instructed the police to execute that order within 24 hours. And but gave him time to appeal, but the order had to be executed immediately. And yes, the bullet was extricated. Mm-hmm. Ballistic tests were run on the bullet, and yes, it was shown that he was in fact the criminal that was present at the crime scene, and the rest is history.
Now, wouldn't it be great if we could find some singular piece of evidence that would just close this case and show us for once and for all that Jacob Zuma is the guy at the center of all this mess that we've been in for the last 20 years? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Pooms? Pumi?
Pumi is a Zuma fan. Come on, tell us.
Yeah.
You know what, guys? I think there are no surprises there. There are no surprises that he's found yet another reason to not show up, not have his day in court. He's found yet another reason that he can then stand up and say, so even if you put all the measures in place that Canton speaks about, right, even if there's an order that says he has to be examined, that you put a computer in front of his face, all of that, it doesn't make a great story, right? It doesn't further his story that says, I've not been given my opportunity to defend myself. I am not, you know, it gives everybody an opportunity to say, Wenze Nuzuma? Like, why are we surprised? Why are we surprised in even talking about this? But, you know, I'm very fascinated, though, at Peter's story about how complicit international business and big business and banks in particular have been in getting the money out of South Africa, in allowing the transactions, not just for the Guptas, but for many, many other people.
Well, maybe
that I'm very interested.
Maybe, Peter, that you could give us some details on this, because I know that you know, parliamentary privilege doesn't really come into play on this show, but there are things that you probably can tell us about Jacob Zuma. We heard from his spokesperson, Mzwanele Manyi, this week that he has no money ferreted away. He's a poor man who's now asking the rest of South Africa to please donate to help him cover the costs of his legal fees, although he has sons and daughters who are supposedly multi-millionaires. They don't seem to be at the front of the queue donating money. He's asking ordinary, hardworking South Africans to donate money. How difficult is it for people who've been involved in corruption in a country like ours to hide their money internationally? And who are the bad guys here, the banks that help them hide it?
Well, Gareth, it's not just the banks. It's not just HSBC, Standard Chartered, Bank of Baroda, which were the principal conduits for the money laundering. And we're talking about billions of rands. The figures are in my book and in the evidence I gave to the Zondo Commission, and I think are well known. It's not just billions of rands, but it went out through, say, take HSBC. So they have a Johannesburg office and series of offices. Then there's a digital pipeline from their office that goes to Dubai and Hong Kong and London in the main,
right,
which is where the money went. But then what then happens is that a series of shell companies are set up, front companies, which the Guptas stand behind them and the Zumas stand behind them, but their names are not on the kind of nameplate, as it were, but they're completely fictitious companies.
Yeah.
And so the money is sent there, and then it's passed on to another one, and it keeps going. Now, the banks, what it does do is leave a digital footprint.
Right.
So if the banks were really determined to track it down, they could do so. It would be hard, because you've then got a whole series of other actors. You've got the lawyers who set up these companies. You've got the accountants who manipulate it. You've got the auditors, some of them big names like KPMG. You've got the consultants who organize all of this, like McKinsey. And you've then got state agents who buy property and launder the money that way. For example, the Guptas have a prestigious property in Dubai. And then you've got governments, Indian government, the British government, the Chinese government in respect of Hong Kong, the Hong Kong authorities, the UAE, the Dubai ruler. They're all complicit as well, because they haven't done anything about recovering this looted money.
Right.
But you know, so what you have is a whole lot of international actors, agencies, banks, businesses, so-called professional enablers, the consultants, the estate agents, the lawyers, and so on, the auditors, that they're the ones earning fat fees from all of this, which is taxpayers' money, your taxpayers'
right.
money.
Correct. After all. Absolutely.
So that's the broader picture to it all.
So, I mean, there are two levels to this corruption, and you almost have to admire begrudgingly the fact that it takes quite a lot of architecture to make these things happen. You know, it's not easy. It's not like robbing a bank. Robbing a bank would be much simpler than this. There's, first of all, the corruption itself. You have to get the money from state-owned entities, from the taxpayer directly, from Treasury, wherever you manage to steal it from. And you have to gain control of the wheels of power. And then you have to also make an entire system outside of that that can help you hide the money. It's a very, very complex thing to do, and something that people, it irritates me when people say, Jacob Zuma and the Guptas are just, common or garden thieves. They're really not. These are very, very smart, very, very technologically advanced creations, these vehicles that they use. And there are lots and lots of people involved along the way. So it's always easier to hide a body if you're the only one who knows where it is. But there are a lot of people who could be implicated here. How do we go after them, Peter?
Well, you can only do it, I've concluded, if you get governments across the world to prioritize it. When over $2 trillion $2 trillion yes. US dollars is laundered in financial crime every year.
Yes.
So we're not just talking about the South African state capture episode with all its scandalous looting and so on. We're talking about this is going on all the time. And it is not just about the Zumas and the Guptas in the South African case doing their looting and their money laundering. Drug traffickers use the same conduits, financial conduits. People traffickers do. Mm-hmm. Terrorists do. What is interesting is some of these same methods of money laundering have been used by Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda and ISIS and so on. So it's organized crime on a global scale. And the thing that really struck me, and I didn't really understand this until I started getting involved, and particularly since I had some expert advice before I gave my evidence to the Zondo Commission, is that this is extremely complex in one sense, and it's actually quite simple in another, and it's happening all the time, and these very respectable, some of them household names across the world, of these global corporates, they're up to their necks in it. And when these guys came to see me in my office in Westminster, because they were very worried about their reputation. I mean, they didn't mind if they were being criticized in Johannesburg, but once they were criticized at their headquarters in New York and in London, they started getting concerned about their share prices and their reputations globally. And then I said to the banks, well, you've admitted you had the Guptra accounts. You say you've closed them down now. Well, why don't you collaborate with the South African Treasury, with any of us trying to uncover any of this? And they've been, Andrew Feinstein and others have been delving into this from London in much greater detail, with much more forensic expertise than I could ever muster on my own. Why don't you cooperate? Because you are, they said, but client confidentiality.
Oh, please.
So, I mean, my point is the four of us on this program, we're all honest citizens, or hope we are. We're entitled to client confidentiality.
I don't know. I mean, put me in Canton have got very shady backgrounds. So wait till their books come out. When Pumi and Canton's books come out, they won't be called The Story of South Africa's Public Enemy Number 1. It'll be South Africa's Public Enemy Number 2 and 3. So that's
very unfair. But my point is we're entitled to client confidentiality. But, international criminals like
they
these guys
be.
Surely are not.
No, there shouldn't be. So is any of you going to be helping to raise funds for Jacob Zuma's legal defense? I mean, come on. You're all capable people. You seem like you're conscientious. You seem like you're also caring. Doesn't our former president, he's almost 80 years old, doesn't he deserve a little bit of cash to help pay for his legal fees?
I saw someone make an interesting proposition, and I apologize for not giving credit to the person because I didn't take note at the time. The idea is to make a cash deposit into Zuma's account that is small enough that the amount that he pays in bank fees for the cash transaction is going to be more than the amount of money one deposits into the account.
And then he ends up with even more debt.
Exactly.
Not very nice.
Well, there are many crowdfunding initiatives currently happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either you're believing in Zwane Limanye and crowdfunding for Baba's legal fees, or you're crowdfunding for the ANC's salary bill. I mean, there's so many ways.
Well, can we talk about the ANC salary bill?
Absolutely. Because, let's get into this. This is hilarious.
Question that I was putting out yesterday, and it's kind of interesting to see how these things come out, because I asked people on Twitter for specific examples of how Jacob Zuma is a better president than Cyril Ramaphosa. And of course, I have the usual praise singers from both sides climbing in. Up there, of course, they're saying, well, you know, Ramaphosa is not corrupt, and Jacob Zuma is clearly corrupt, and so forth. The fundamental issue for me is that Cyril Ramaphosa is head of the ANC. He is the president of the African National Congress. Now, the African National Congress is not able to pay its own salary bill. Cyril Ramaphosa is an actual billionaire. Now, surely Cyril Ramaphosa has enough smarts to understand that the thing that he does as leader of this organization is to actually whip them into shape, give them a loan to cover their expenses in the short term, but keep this entire mess out of the public eye. But this guy completely lacks any sense of understanding that the correct thing to do is to keep his own house in order first. This is the equivalent of all of these guys you see outed on Twitter all the time who are spending massive amounts of money on car payments and mm-hmm. on junkets for expensive weekends, but they're not able to pay their pubkeld.
Yeah, their maintenance, their children.
And this is Cyril Ramaphosa in a nutshell. And anyone who thinks that this man has the leadership capability to actually run the country, they are completely around the bend. Leaders eat last. You know, this is another saying from a South African, a former South African, as in Simon Sinek.
Mm-hmm.
Leaders eat last. He should first be sorting out his entire own flipping organization. I'm so utterly disgusted by
well,
this guy.
Apparently it's not just financial problems, because the ANC couldn't even get their party list in properly the other day. They've missed out on a whole number of deadlines, and we're actually going to challenge the entire electoral process and have the elections postponed because of their own incompetence in submitting their own list for the election that's coming up, the municipal and local elections, which are just around the corner. Pums, what did you want to say? I interrupted you.
No, I'm just saying, so both those things for me are incredibly interesting to watch, as I've been saying for months now on the show, that this is the end, right? This is the beginning of the end for this party. And I'm, again, going to have to direct this question to Lord Hayne here to say, your parents were in the Liberal Party of South Africa, a party that no longer exists. So you have seen the party die. Is this, are these some of the signs of how a party's demise comes about?
Yeah.
Well, I think the ANC will die unless it completely reforms itself and it goes back to its original mission, its noble mission, which was to overthrow apartheid and to establish a constitutional democracy. And to be fair, the South Africa's constitution, probably the best in the world, is the creature of Oliver Tambo, the leader of the ANC for all those decades when Mandela was in prison, and Albie Sachs, and in the main. And they, you know, that was a noble party with a noble mission, but it's become corrupted and become dysfunctional. I don't agree with what's just been said about Cyril Ramaphosa, by the way. I think South Africa is lucky to have him. I don't see anybody who rivals him for his experience, his skills, whether as a struggle hero, as a trade union negotiator and leader, as a business leader, as a constitutional negotiator. He was the one on behalf of Nelson Mandela and the leadership who did negotiate the transition and the new constitution. So I think you're very lucky to have him, quite frankly, though he's hemmed in by some bad guys and girls, because, of course, his victory over the Zuma rights was very narrow. I'm not saying he's perfect. I don't like a lot of the things that are going on more than any of us do, but I think you're very lucky to have him. But to answer your question about the future of the ANC, I think it will die. All parties... No party has a God-given right to rule forever or to be in existence forever.
The ANC, there were a couple of people in the ANC who actually did claim exactly that not so long ago, that the ANC will be here until Jesus comes, were their exact words. But Peter, you've said something which shouldn't be controversial, that maybe Cyril's the best of a really bad bunch of politicians available to us. But this is quite controversial in South Africa at the moment, because a lot of the things that you said about Cyril are kind of ancient history. There's a leadership vacuum at the moment that many of us are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And I know you pay attention, so I don't mean to sound in any way patronizing or rude about this, but there are things that he's just not doing, and he's had so many opportunities here to grab the reins with both hands and to even to use coronavirus, frankly, as an excuse to do some of the things that he's needed to do for the longest time, and he just never takes them. We had a cabinet reshuffle the other day where he just moved around the deck chairs in the Titanic and put the same old people that have been in the ANC hierarchy since Mandela's time. He just moved them around into new departments. And it's done nothing to improve service delivery for poor people, infrastructure. In this case, the vaccine rollout, the health minister himself was implicated in corruption and is now apparently going to be looked into by the Special Investigations Unit and by the law. I mean, there are various court cases pending against him. So there are things going on at the moment that do poor old Cyril very little good in terms of PR. And I know Pumi disagrees with you because she doesn't tread lightly around Cyril Ramaphosa. I mean, Canton, Pumi, did I leave some things out there?
Well, I think the recent example of the past couple of days, Gareth, is something significant in this case, which is his former spokesperson, Kusela Diko. Now, Kusela Diko was finally suspended after much public outrage over the fact that her husband had been awarded a dodgy contract.
Yeah.
And she was suspended on full pay, I must say, for the past period. And now we've been told that the investigation is over and she's going to be deployed into another position. And it turns out that the other position, according to reports that are out this morning, is going to be as Deputy Director General at Government Communications and Information System.
Yeah.
So once again, this is a scenario where you have patent involvement in criminality, and our president fails to act. And in fact, he ends up rewarding the person. We have a similar scenario in terms of the recent cabinet rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, with Thandi Modise now being moved into
defense,
into defense, and Nosiviwe Mapisa Nqakula being moved to speaker.
Mm.
You know, how completely outrageous is this? You essentially fire the woman from cabinet for incompetence and then promptly put her into a position that's paying her even more money. Mm. And this has been a hallmark of Cyril Ramaphosa's entire tenure. And I'm not prepared to accept anything that says that he's forced to do this because of internal ructions within the ANC. No, the thing that he needs to do is to actually be presidential. And being presidential means firing the lot from the cabinet, depriving them of their ability to be funded by the state, appoint competent people to cabinet, and treat himself as a one-term president who's actually going to completely clean up the rot that is in government. And he's failing to do it. And the reason why he's failing to do it is because the ANC will always, always put the party before the country.
And not even the party, because we can see the ANC's, the party's breaking down, but even individuals in the party who are considered loyal cadres. Those are the people who get preferential treatment. It's not even the party, because there are lots and lots of members of the ANC all over who've never benefited personally from anything and never will, because they're not connected to the right people. Pums?
But what we haven't heard is why you believe South Africa is lucky to have Cyril Ramaphosa as a president. And we hear that statement, but the why is what I'm interested in hearing. Think lucky to have him.
I'm sorry, Peter, to have put you in the position where you become Cyril Ramaphosa's cheerleader this morning. That was not my intention. But can you answer Pumi's question? Why are we lucky to have him?
Well, it's not my part of my responsibility to act as a cheerleader for anybody at the top of South African politics. I'm simply telling it as I see it.
Okay.
There was only one person, and that was because of the ANC's internal politics, likely to defeat the Zuma machine, and that was Ramaphosa. There's nobody else going to do it. So you have to make a choice. Was were you going to support him or more of the same? And I think what we have seen, far too slowly, far too frustratingly slowly, is change happening. People are being arrested who would never have been arrested before. Institutions, whether it's the Revenue Service or the police, are slowly beginning, or the National Prosecution Authority, beginning to be cleaned up. This is a long, hard slog. And it is frustratingly slow. I mean, I refer to this in the last chapter of my book, where I offer some thoughts from my perspective. I've become only one opinion amongst all of you on this program and anybody watching or listening. But I'm frustrated as well about the slowness of the change, because South Africa desperately needs shaking out of where it's been to move forward. And there is a lack of capacity around the presidency and a lack of delivery around the government. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been a government minister. I know how difficult it is actually to do things. It may sound odd to the rest of you for me to say that, but it is true, even in a country like Britain, which doesn't have the apartheid legacy, has a longer institutionalized professional civil service and so on. It's difficult to make change.
Right.
And I think Ramaphosa is grappling with that. But, you know, I think South Africa is lucky to have him, because the alternative was massively worse. I think we can all agree with that.
In other words, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed is king. Mm. That's kind of what we're...
No. That's not my argument, and that's a misrepresentation of what I'm saying, Gareth, as you well know, because you're laughing like hell at me.
Gareth, I've got to say that I agree to a large extent with most of the stuff that Peter Hannes said. We've spoken about that on this show before in terms of the capacity of the National Prosecution Authority, for example, to actually implement change based on the fact that the entire structure was filled with Jacob Zuma deployees.
Yes.
And there had to be a process where those people actually rooted out. We have entire structures of government where the directors general of the various departments, again, are Zuma deployees who are in a position to actually completely obstruct the ability to put in place those. And yes, I agree that the change process is slow.
Yeah.
But this doesn't detract from the fact that one of the biggest reasons why the change process is slow is because of failure of leadership on the part of the president to actually act when there is opportunity to actually do so. One of the things that hasn't actually been spoken about enough was the abrupt departure of Tito Mboweni from the cabinet. And there have been hints by Tito Mboweni in terms of his Twitter feed for some months now that he was having major conflicts in terms of the Ramaphosa administration and being able to do a couple of things. The one is, of course, to enforce the fiscal discipline that he believes in. And he does believe in the fiscal discipline.
Right.
Because whenever any of the other ministers came around and they said, we need money for X, Y, and Z, he said, no, you can't have it, because we're not going to borrow more money to fund this. But I'd also like to take us back a couple of years when So this was in fact, it was roughly on this date 2 years ago when Tito Mboweni released a document from National Treasury called Economic Transformation, Inclusive Growth and Competitiveness mm-hmm. Towards an Economic Strategy for South Africa. And I'm just going to touch on a couple of points very quickly, you know, just bullet points in terms of what he wanted to put in place. Right. This was 2 years ago. He said government should have exemptions for small business in bargaining council agreements. Did not happen. Encourage immigration from skilled workers with tertiary qualifications from accredited institutions. Did not happen. Metro rail should be handed to the metros as part of an integrated transport plan. Did not happen. Transnet should become a rail infrastructure provider, but private companies should have access to their network. Did not happen. Substantial reforms in electricity generation and delivery. Well, effectively, what we've got there are the Turkish power ships up until now. Mm-hmm. Okay. Ending of supermarket monopolies. And this is in terms of the fact that if, for example, Pick and Pay is an anchor tenant in a supermarket, Checkers is not allowed to be in the same supermarket.
Yeah.
Structures for pricing of fuel needs to change. All of these things.
Good ideas, all of them.
All of them good ideas, and I think all of which are things that we've spoken about on the show before, mm-hmm. can immediately kickstart the South African economy. Cyril has been sitting on this for 2 years. He's had opportunity.
It's worse than that, isn't it? I mean, when it was released by Tito, there was a widespread disenchantment in the rest of cabinet and the ANC at large. They said that this is not what we believe, and this is not a good plan, and we don't like this.
That's absolutely right. And really, at that stage, Ramaphosa could have actually exercised leadership to say that, you know, as the ANC, we believe that these things actually need to be discussed
okay.
and aired in public, as opposed to be held behind the scene. So yes, absolutely right. Ramaphosa is the best of a bad lot right now. But in fact, that is an obstacle to the people of this country actually being able to see just what a poisonous institution the African National Congress actually
has become.
Is. They are committed to the concept of the National Democratic Revolution. They have no commitment right now in terms of any values of a traditional liberal democracy. Their role model happens to be the Chinese Communist Party. That is exactly the type of structure that they want to impose upon this country. And frankly, I think that if you had someone like Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma actually holding the reins of government, it would be far easier for the people of this country to see the ANC for what it is. Ramaphosa has a beautiful speaking voice, and that means that it allows that forked tongue of his to actually inflict far more damage behind the scene.
All right. So it would be remiss of me. I'm going to give you both the right to reply to what Canton just said now, even though it wasn't about anything controversial that you've brought up necessarily or counterposed to any of that. But I do want to get into some international stuff. So anything left on South Africa that you'd like to say? Pumi, Peter Hain?
I'm
going to
let Peter go first. Oh, okay. So I think it'll be fascinating to see what happens with the elections. You know, it's one of my favorite things is looking at the numbers and the turnouts. And with the ANC, I think they said that they're not contested. They haven't put in their list for about a third of the municipalities.
Wow.
That means, and we've got new players. We had Mr. Mashaba here last week. It's going to be fascinating to see. It's going to be fascinating to see if people do actually show up to vote and how they tend to vote. And in places where the ANC is not even there on the ballot, how people show up to vote in those places is going to be a real interesting thing to look at, to see how people are reacting to the shambles that is the ANC. And it will give us a little bit of an indication on what we can look for in 2024.
My observation is you've got not only a dysfunctional ANC, you've actually got a dysfunctional opposition. And governments, and I've been in government, and I've been part of a losing Labour government in 2010 after 13 years of actually successful government, but we lost in 2010 for all sorts of reasons. You've got to be kept true by facing the threat of losing.
Yeah.
And the longer parties are in power, and we've seen this so terribly in Zimbabwe, but you could see it elsewhere as well. Putin in Russia at the moment, for example, the Chinese Communist Party. The longer you're in power, the more complacent you get, the more corruption occurs, the more you're not kept on your mettle. Democracy is a great instrument for keeping people accountable. It's very imperfect, and you know, the Brexit vote, for example, I thought was disastrous for Britain. So democracy can produce all sorts of undesirable outcomes, but it is the best of the options. But you know, you don't have a functioning opposition in South Africa of any serious or credible kind. There was one. The DA looked in around up to 2017, when a lot of municipal elections and city elections went against the ANC. It looked as if at last the ANC was being made accountable. Mm-hmm. But I don't see that happening. What I worry about is decline. Pumi, you implied this, declining turnout, as there's greater and greater disillusionment with the whole of politics.
Right.
A splintering of opposition, which is not a healthy thing, because it means there's no one party that can genuinely displace the ruling party.
Correct.
And the whole sort of system limping along in a dysfunctional way, unless there's a big shake-up in the ANC, I think that's more likely. I don't see the DA providing credible opposition. I certainly don't think the EFF will or should command support. I don't see it winning any sort of serious support, because of its authoritarianism and its populism and all the corruption around it and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's what my main concern is, in brief, Gareth.
I think that's
declining turnout, splintering opposition, and politics sort of just gradually atrophying in the country, and that's not healthy.
Well, let's hope for the high road rather than the one last mentioned. Thank you all for those comments on the local situation. If we can just turn our attention to the big world story at the moment, the US has finally completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I know that all three of you are also very much au fait with what's going on in the world of politics. How does this reflect on the United States, their position in the world going forward, foreign policy in the future, Joe Biden's presidency, and the fact that his poll numbers are dropping precipitously since his decision to withdraw from Afghanistan? So what comments do we have on this? Pums, do you want to start, and then I'll let the gentleman go first, go after you, sorry.
No, I don't want to start, because you know my stance on this. No, because you do know my stance on this, and I think the listeners have heard it before. I think it would be of much value for us to hear Lord Peter Hain as an international player as well first.
Okay. What do you have to say about Afghanistan, Lord Hain?
Well, Gareth, first of all, let's go back to the beginning. I was in government. I was part of the government. I was actually in the British Foreign Office when the invasion, when 9/11 happened,
right,
and the invasion took place to try and get rid of Al-Qaeda and stop anything like 9/11 happening again. That was the motivation at the time. But actually, in retrospect, what then... First of all, Afghanistan has never accepted foreign invaders, going back to the British in the 19th century, the Russians, the Soviets in the 1970s.
Graveyard of empires.
Yeah, driven out of Afghanistan. So I don't think in retrospect there was any prospect of this mission, 20-year mission, ending in a tidy way, if I could use that phrase.
Sure.
I think we can all criticize the Biden administration, the British administration, which was, you know, in lockstep with the US on all of this, and, you know, others involved, France, etc. Can all criticize the manner of a withdrawal, the desperate plight of Afghans who are now facing persecution by the Taliban. The really concerning future for women in Afghanistan. One of the successes of the last two decades was the opportunities for women that now look like being closed down, mm-hmm, tragically. So, but I think in retrospect, what should have happened was a much more surgical approach to eradicate Al-Qaeda. They couldn't be left there. To allow that to happen was simply to invite more 9/11s anywhere in the world. So that had to be dealt with. I think it could have been done in retrospect in a more surgical fashion rather than whole-scale invasion. There was never an attempt to really negotiate with the Pashtun, who formed the largest group in Afghanistan, which is itself quite a fragmented society, or with the Taliban. The Taliban, as we've seen now, odious though a lot of their policies and reactionary they are towards human rights, particularly towards women's rights, they represent, you know, a great big constituency in Afghanistan. And instead of just shunning them and deeming them as terrorists and cold shouldering them and putting, you know, attracting forces in Afghanistan who were sympathetic to Washington and to Western policy, and that's failed. It should have been trying from the beginning to negotiate with them and treat them with some respect that they deserve, whether or not you agree with them. I you know, just one final point on this. Tony Blair's former chief of staff, with whom I worked very closely when I was Secretary of State for Northern Ireland and negotiated the 2007 peace settlement that brought the bitter old blood enemies into sharing government together. Jonathan Powell wrote a book called Talking to Terrorists. And he said, in the end, you don't resolve wars, you don't resolve conflicts by continuing to fight. In the end, there's always a negotiated solution. And we see this in Colombia, we've seen this in the Basque country, in Spain, all across the world.
Right.
And I think that lesson, in retrospect, should have been learned from the beginning.
Well,
and it was never going to be easy for Biden or the British or anybody to get out of Afghanistan in a tidy way.
But surely the argument that this could have been a more surgical and more well-thought-through plan to just extirpate Al-Qaeda and to otherwise leave Afghanistan to its own devices and not necessarily make it an imperial project. That's a very good point that I don't think anyone's going to disagree with. But then the same logic should be applied to the withdrawal. It should have been a more strategic, more well thought through plan. And, you know, Joe Biden's saying at the moment, well, Donald Trump put certain timelines in place. It's never stopped any previous administration from overturning the bad decisions of their predecessor. And maybe this could have been handled better, you know, to withdraw the army first and then leave civilians to be pulled out and then pretend that this is a great decision when you've had to send more troops in than you already had there in order to oversee the withdrawal. It seems like it was very much cart before the horse rather than horse before the cart here. I mean, what do you think, Canton?
I think that the outrage that we're currently seeing around the entire Afghanistan debacle is going to be forgotten by the time the next U.S. presidential election comes around. So from that point of view, the net impact in terms of Joe Biden, I think, is going to be non-existent. We have short memories in terms of politics.
Wow.
And I don't think it's going to affect his administration in the long term. What I find significant about what's going on right now is that I think that there's going to be a fairly drastic realignment in terms of a number of people who have worked on the assumption that the United States would be there as a bulwark against other forces. So, for example, Taiwan, for example, if right now, if I was in the Taiwanese leadership, I would be incredibly nervous. Israel is another example. You know, no matter the historical alliance between Israel and the United States, I'm pretty sure right now that the Israelis are actually quite nervous about what Biden is up to. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see the Bennett government actually falling and again being replaced by a Netanyahu government, just simply based on the fact that when the shit hits the fan, they want a hard bastard behind the controls that's actually steering the ship.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is how
using that as an example, look across to, I think, South Korea. is going to also be looking very long and hard in terms of the fact that right now a lot of their defense is based on the fact that they have U.S. troops on their territory. What happens if the U.S. suddenly decides abruptly to pull out from that space?
By the way, ten times the number of troops they had in Afghanistan. I think it's 25,000 troops are stationed in South Korea at the moment and have been pretty much in those numbers or greater ones since the end of the Korean War. Afghanistan had, I think, 2,500 troops stationed there up to the moment that Joe Biden started the withdrawal. So if this is how America is treating its allies, do you agree that there are many of their allies that are going to be as uncomfortable and as nervous as Canton says they are? Lord Hayne?
Well, there has been a breakdown in multilateralism that was, you know, symbolized by Trump. And Trump just was America first. We've got that symbolized that. And Biden's, you know, picked up some of that baggage. I'm not excusing him, but there's a bit of that in the psyche of American politics at the moment. You've got a very dangerous situation where you've got China first, and you've referred to Taiwan. You've got Russia first. You've then got, you know, other smaller players, but quite significant in their areas, like Erdogan, Turkey first. You've got Britain first. Forget about our place in Europe, and that was the motivation behind Brexit. So you've got a dangerous weakening of multilateralism and the international institutions that came out of the Second World War, including the United Nations Security Council, which is pretty impotent in all of this. And that's what I see as the danger of where the world is going. And you've seen it close at home, and Africa has been, including South Africa, a victim of this on the vaccination issue, where you know, the richer countries, Britain at the top of the queue, has grabbed all the vaccines, and instead of recognizing that none of us are safe until all of us are safe with this pandemic. So I think, or whether it's climate change, you know, you can't deal with the problems of the world unless you act in a concerted way, unless the international institutions of multilateralism are rescued from their impotence at the present time. So I think that's the backdrop to what's happened here and the way America's likely to be behaving, and Canton made the point about Israel and so on. I think that's the backdrop. Until we start putting international institutions first and realize that we're actually stronger together than on our own, even America, then I think we're going to face very turbulent times.
Well, thank you all three. Pums, you're on mute. I think if you wanted to say something, hop back on.
Oh, yeah.
There we are. Go ahead.
I was saying, I think what it does do, which is something that a lot of people find it very unpalatable, and we're not talking about it, is the fact that the Taliban is now also emboldened as America withdraws. So the things that we hated about what the Taliban were doing in Afghanistan is going to come back stronger and harder, and they're emboldened, not only by historically the idea that Afghanistan is this graveyard of empires, which, as Canton talks to, all the allies of America are also going to start saying these guys are weak.
Yeah.
and I can't depend on these guys. They're going to be emboldened, and the things we hated about what was happening in Afghanistan is going to become more evident. It's going to be more in Afghanistan, but also in the surrounding countries.
Well, that's the scary part. I was really hoping that the three of you would bring a little optimism to our Thursday morning too, but I mean, I can't expect you to work miracles. So,
how about some realism? Let's be real here.
I'm quite optimistic about this, Gareth, because I actually think that, and don't get me wrong, I'm very firmly in favor of multilateralism, but I do think that there has been a scenario for far too long where people have become complacent based specifically on their dependence on the United States. And I think that those relationships need to be reevaluated, and they need to be very coldly reevaluated. And they need to, And to a large extent, I can see a scenario where all of those players now turn around to the United States and say, yes, we want to return to a scenario where we're actually engaging on the basis of mutual self-interest, but there have to be rules in place that we are agreeing upon ahead of time. Mm. And we are not going to have a scenario where we're just going to assume that the U.S. is the big brother that's going to be dictating the terms of engagement. I think that's a good thing. So, yeah, let's treat that as optimism.
I'm afraid at this point I'm going to have to call the party to an end. But Lord Hayne, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on the new book, which I encourage everybody to take a look at. It's available in good bookstores now.
And I'm certainly looking forward to seeing it.
Yes, absolutely. It's called A Pretoria Boy.
Thank you.
The story of South Africa's public enemy number one, Lord Peter Hayne. It's a great pleasure to have you on the show this morning, and thank you for being part of The Burning Platform.
Thank you very much for having me, and nice to meet Kanthan and Pumi as well.
Great to see you, sir. Thank you. And Pumi, Kanthan, good to have a little reunion with both of you. I'm sorry that we ran out of time to talk about all the things that we needed to discuss in politics, but I thought it was a great opportunity to have Peter Hayne's comments on Afghanistan. And let's see what happens. I mean, there's never a dull week. And Kanthan, good luck for the upcoming birthday.
Well, I hope to see you there, Gareth.
Absolutely.
You are family after all.
We'll break some COVID rules, I'm sure. Very good. All right, everybody.
Later,
and
guys.
Because you don't work for the government, you're not going to get like a salary doc.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Very good. Thanks, everybody. See you tomorrow at 6 o'clock, bright and early. Cheers. CliffCentral.com.